Hey, you. Yeah, you. Do you know who Wild Redberry is? You know who Saul Weingroff is? Or Bobby Davis? Or even Al Costello? You wouldn't know, would you, you young punk? Ah, it's the Outdated Wrestling Hour.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bob Smith. Welcome to the latest edition of the Outdated Wrestling Hour. I used to work for Pro Wrestling Illustrated with Craig Peterson, Bill Apter, and the whole crew there. Stu Sachs, Roy London, Andy Rodriguez, Dave Rosenbaum, Chris Bernuka, Al Bello. The list goes on. Eddie Elner. And on it went. Joey Styles for a while. Lucky guy. I am a lucky guy. Anyway, it's many years later, and now I'm doing the Outdated Wrestling Hour, this funky little podcast, where last week we had a nice interview with Todd Gordon, at least I thought it was nice, and then the wrestling media exploded with headline after headline over some of the quotes that Todd made. Of course, they couldn't get the name of the show right, but hey, you know, SEO, you know? But anyway, his book, Todd is God, comes out July 25th. It's going to be a blockbuster, and it's going to be fun. And I suggest you get a copy of that. Reserve your copy now. I've reserved mine, and I'm cheap, so you really ought to get one too. This episode, we're going to have a little fun. We're going to go back to our normal format of loving traditional professional wrestling and talking about the old days. And I'm going to do that with a very fine gentleman by the name of Joe Puccio, who I've gotten to know through the magic of social media, the magic of Twitter. Get me out of there, please. Can I get out of there? But I met him through Twitter, and we had some nice discussions, and we've been trying to coordinate our schedules to get him on the show all this time. Wait till you hear his resume. He has worked at some of the top places, and he's a real journalist, and I'm really happy to be able to make his acquaintance on this particular show. A little housekeeping before we get started. July 1st, I'm going to be in Philly. Icons of Wrestling Convention, 2300 Arena. Come say hello to me. I'm going to have a vendor table. I don't know where it's going to be located, probably in between the penny whistles and the plush dolls of Brutus Beefcake. I will be selling nothing. I just want to shake some hands, make some friends, see some old buddies of mine. I'll sign some pictures that I have. If you have old magazines, I'll sign them, whatever you like. You know, end up sitting there like the lead actor in the wrestler film, but so what? I am there just to have a good time and drink in the atmosphere. It's my first convention in 30 years, my friends. So I'm looking forward to seeing your smiling faces. Icons of Wrestling, there's going to be a lot of great stars there. Check it out online. Be there. It's affordable and fun. You ought to make your plans now because it looks like things are getting hot and heavy in that regard. And it looks like the roads to Philadelphia will be back in operation, which is a wonderful thing. I'm sorry for all the trouble that Philadelphia had recently. Let's talk about those old school bad guys. Yes, I use the term bad guys. Good guys and bad guys. Wrestling. Pro wrestling. And here's a good guy, Mr. Joe Puccio. Joe, you didn't hear it, but I just gave you an introduction. And ladies and gentlemen, this is my first guest who is coming to a podcast with an actual podcasting mic. I'm in heaven. I'm in Podcaster 7. Joe Puccio, thank you for being here.
Bob, thanks so much for having me. I've had a couple of postponements on this, but it was mostly because of me. But I'm really glad that I'm here now and that we're able to do this. Looking forward to it.
Well, one thing that I do here, in addition to we're going to talk about wrestling managers and things like that in a little bit. But what I want to do is introduce the folks to you. You sent me a kind of a truncated resume, and I was floored. You have done a lot of things in wrestling. Could you explain to our guests who you've worked for and what you've done?
Sure, sure. For the last, I'd say, six or seven years, I was the main wrestling writer for Royal Flush Magazine online, pop culture website. They also do print, but in the last few years, they've really moved more towards online, as many have. They needed a wrestling writer. I had some background in it. I did wrestling writing here and there. So I became their writer, doing interviews, interviewing people like Ted DiBiase, Jacques Rougeau, Tito Santana, Danny Davis, Leap and Lanny Poffo, different, names throughout the industry, mostly old timers. Did a lot of interviews, covered a lot of shows. I took off from there. I also write for a couple of wrestling websites currently, eWrestling News and a couple of others. I grew up major wrestling fan. I was a newsletter subscriber to all the big ones, The Observer, The Torch, the same ones that all of us have. Big magazine reader, obviously Pro Wrestling Illustrated. I was a big Wrestling Eye fan, Wrestling Fury. and those I'm sure ring a bell. So, I mean, you know, I lived it. I breathed it when I was younger. I've just kind of kept at it. You know, it's not my quote unquote real job. My real job is I work for a newswire service similar to the AP. But I'm able to do this in my spare time, and I have a lot of fun at it. And even though I'm in my mid-40s now, you know, and it doesn't feel exactly the same as it did when I was growing up in the 80s, it's I still enjoy it, especially talking about wrestling the way it was.
You're still a kid. I was looking over your history here, too. It says, years ago, you were a weekly reporter for Dave Meltzer's website, handling the WWE. Version of ECW.
That's correct.
Of course, that was ECW, like I'm Vin Diesel, but I will say at least you got to watch Tiffany, which isn't half bad. So, you know,
that's right. It wasn't a
total loss.
That is true. You needed anything to really get through those shows, I have to admit, back in the day. But yeah, that was really cool. And I reached out to Dave. I've contributed to Dave's newsletter over the years. And I reached out to him at the time. He was looking for a weekly reporter. Basically, you'd watch the show and you'd report on it right after the show was over. You'd send in your play-by-play, so to speak, of the show. And that was cool. I did that for a while. Obviously, that wasn't on the air too long. But that worked out really well. Another, I guess, wrestling background, you could say, is I also had several interviews with WWE. Which I don't think I mentioned to you previously, but I'd say about 10 or 15 years ago, I interviewed in Stamford for writing positions, for computer website positions. One of my interviews was with Michael Cole, a few others with the writers at the time. I don't know if you're familiar with Brian Gewirtz. Gewirtz, sure. Was the Raw sure. writer at the time. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, he wrote a great book, yeah.
Yeah. And the guy on SmackDown, I believe his name was Dave Lagana, was the SmackDown writer that I interviewed with. So I did a few. I was supposed to interview with Stephanie McMahon, but she had to run out for a meeting or something. So I missed that opportunity.
Winston. So the reason you are here, you and I talked about doing something about professional wrestling managers over the years. And as I like to say in the show, there is no best, there is no worst. All right. This is not what these things are about. Point of view on these things is remembering the people that thrilled us when we were cutting our teeth on professional wrestling. When we were kids, teenagers, into our adult years, some performers just have it. They've got that certain X factor that makes them amongst the greats of the greats. And the managers are the same way. Let's get into the managers. Now, I'll start because I'm a little older than you are. I don't know if you know this. But I started watching wrestling probably around 1969, 1970. In Albany, I was from upstate, and the Federation was Pedro Martinez's NWF, featuring Johnny Powers. He was the champion with Ernie Ladd and George Crybaby Cannon and the Mongols and a whole mess of people. But I all my life, I've read the articles. I've gotten reams of videotape, and I have to start the list with Bobby Heenan from probably around 1969 through whenever he decided to stop managing. What a talent. What a talker. What a wrestler. Did you ever have the opportunity to see him wrestle?
I did not. Obviously not from the time I became a fan, but I have seen footage of him. And I wanted to say the guy is an underrated wrestler.
Unbelievably underrated, yes.
Nobody thinks of him that way, but the guy definitely could go.
He could definitely go. Nobody could fly out of the ring like he did.
Mm-hmm.
Looked like he was getting killed. That one hand on the top rope, and boom, down he went. But I'll tell you, the guy had it all. I mean, he really did. And he was fodder for the magazines because he would juice like ocean spray. And, you know, he was just absolutely willing to say or do anything in that time. Dave Dynasty, who we had on the show a few weeks ago, put some tapes on from the old WWA out of Indianapolis where he really started. And it shows him in six-man tag team matches and in other matches. Had the psychology for the minute he started working. I mean, he was kind of like, it's kind of like at Larry Zbyszko as a wrestler, stall, you know? And yeah. By the time he would lock up with somebody, the fans wanted to kill him, you know? And great interview, even better color commentator, television personality. He had it all. It's hard for me not to call him the greatest of all time, but he's definitely on my short list. And I don't know if you feel the same way, but he was, even in the WWE in the late managing Andre the Giant, getting the heat for WrestleMania 3, good as it gets.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the WWA and some of the footage, and that was Dick the Bruiser's promotion, right? That's right.
Indiana, right.
Yeah, and I saw some of that footage. That's where he obviously cut his teeth, and I think that's where he got the Weasel nickname. Yes. In the first place.
Sure.
Right? Yeah, because I mean it obviously lasted all those years, but I think it might have been from Dick the Bruiser.
Oh, I think so too. And I'll tell you what, you know, even late period when he wrestled the Ultimate Warrior.
Oh yeah.
He was forced to put on a weasel suit. I think he had done that long before in the AWA. You know, and the AWA, Bockwinkel and Stevens and everything else, good gravy. I mean, as good as it gets.
It's true.
You would think wrestling was real after listening to Bockwinkel and Heenan talk.
You're right.
They would suck you in with their psychology during their interviews, and they wouldn't let you go. And anybody watching that TV screen didn't think that what they were watching was fake. To me, that's the big thing.
Right.
They were so realistic in their verbiosity, so to speak. They could just talk and talk and make you think it was a real deal. And because they were the real deal, you know, they were the best. So I don't know how you feel about it, but Heenan was, wow.
And part of that making it feel like it was real, you know, part of that was the unscripted nature back then. I mean, back then, you know, Heenan didn't have a writer, you know, writing what he was going to say. You know, he went out there and, you know, he felt it, you know, and he thought off. That's why maybe he would stop or he'd stutter here and there, but that made it seem real because what he was saying really seemed like it was coming from him, which is obviously very different than the modern era of wrestling where everything is like robotic.
Bobby Heenan's ad-libs were far more realistic than anything a WWE writer has ever fed to a wrestler or manager.
Yep.
Case closed.
Yep.
Bobby Heenan could vamp better than than what they're coming up with now for these guys to say. So I don't know what else to say. But you know, we're probably preaching to our choir here of our listeners. They all know about Bobby Heenan. They thought he was great.
Well, yeah. I'll just say that Heenan, I 100% wanted to make sure I get this out there, that 100% agree. I know it's sort of the easy answer, but in my personal opinion, the GOAT, as far as managers go, I've never seen anybody perform that role better than him. There have been others that are close, but as far as I'm concerned, if you had to pick one, I don't think you get any better than Heenan.
Well, you know, I'm going to put a few on a par with him, or a couple others on a par, I should say. But like I said, I don't like to say best. It's all up to the fan, really, to the observer, to the person who was entertained by these people. And going back to the 60s and 70s, I have to bring up Playboy Gary Hart, the thinking man's heel manager. You know, he sounded like a scientist when he talked. Right? He was not your traditional interview. I'm going to get you. No, he was soft-spoken, cunning, sly. He was unlike any other manager that I know of. He was understated. Yeah, he'd still scare the pants off of you. What do you think of that?
I got to say, I agree with that. You know, unfortunately, I didn't see too much of Gary Hart in the wrestling that I was watching at the time. It was always sort of in a territory that I wasn't watching while he was around, whatever. But yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you. And he managed some heavyweights. I mean, he had quite a stable. People that don't even remember about who he had, but he definitely had a decent amount of guys in his stable, I guess, so to speak, back in the day.
You know, because he was a vagabond. He worked in so many territories. Who didn't he have? From Abdullah the Butcher to Terry Funk to Japanese wrestlers like Kabuki, and just on and on the list went. I mean,
he's the great Muda, right?
Yes, Muda, exactly.
Yeah.
Just on and on. I mean, I bet he had 75 proteges during his career. And people forget he was a wrestler too. I don't even know if you knew that. He actually donned the tights early in his career. And I saw some early videotapes, black and white matches, and it was Gary Hart.
I knew he was a wrestler, but I don't think I've seen any of the footage.
Long, lean guy. You know, I don't know how successful he was, but it's when they let him talk, I think is when he started to shine. And obviously he went in the right direction because, you know, another fantastic ring psychologist. You know,
yes.
He knew how to sell tickets. He knew how to talk people into the buildings.
Yes.
Long before either of those guys, I have to give a tip of the hat to Bobby Davis, who was Buddy Rogers' manager. And he also managed people like King Curtis in the 60s, too. He had a bunch of when Buddy retired, he kept going for a while. But he was kind of the first rich kid, snotty, like a pre-Jim Cornette type. With all the money in the world, and you know, was just verbose and didn't have a lick of skill, and that's why the fans hated him, because he was just kind of like a moneyed kid, I think was his personality. And he could really talk, he could really go. Most of the managers of that era were like older guys like Wild Red Berry, and you know, older guys who had wrestled but would point their cane at the camera and just kind of grouse. Bobby Davis was different. He was a good looking kid. He was young, he was loud, he was obnoxious, and it worked. He was the perfect foil to the, how you doing, Pally, voice of Buddy Rogers. It worked great. I've only seen a few bits of videotape, but I could tell why they drew money together.
And Bobby Davis, I mean, I know he's most commonly associated with Buddy, but he managed the Graham Brothers as well, did he not?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think it was the Graham Brothers as well. So he had a few people. So I think Johnny Valentine, if I remember correctly, too. But yeah, absolutely.
Another good name. He kept going when Buddy stepped away.
Yeah.
And I think he was kind of a prototype to the Jim Cornettes and people like that who came later.
Yeah.
I think if you asked them, they would say the same thing, you know, with these other managers. Okay, here we go. There is one quote that I have made about any wrestling personality. Very few of them get picked up by other media. I once wrote that I thought Lou Albano was a walking fart. And it got picked up all over the place. Because he was the most slovenly louse of a loudmouth, obnoxious mental case ever presented to East Coast fans. This wild-haired, rubber bands hanging off his chin, sloppy beard, open-shirted, dirty-looking louse. Boy, could he sell tickets.
He was one of a kind. I mean, you know, not much of a little underwhelming as a wrestler. And I think the story with him, if I remember correctly, was didn't Bruno go to Vince Sr. and get him a gig as a manager? I seem to remember reading this in a book. I think that, you know, Bruno was friendly with him and he just said, I think Lou Albano would do really well as a manager. He knows how to talk. He has the gift of gab, and they gave him a shot. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's how that went down. You know, started as a wrestler with the Sicilians and all that, but that guy, I mean, he just, like you said, he looked disgusting. He played that role with ease. It was great. I mean, and he didn't care. He didn't take himself seriously. He went out there. He was the butt of jokes, and he was just so devious.
He was so vile. I mean, he would yell things at ringside I can't repeat here on television. Yeah. On TV. I mean, he was absolutely maniacal. I mean, he was just, I can't, you know, he's the type of guy that he would walk out and women would just gag. I mean, yet he was this shrewdy who could bring his men to a championship, you know, and he did, especially in the tag team division. He managed Ivan Koloff when he beat Bruno. He managed, I think, 14 or 12 tag team champions, starting with, I think it was, the first was Tarzan Tyler and Luke Graham. Second was Cicluna and King Curtis. And then on and on they went. Samoans, the Moondogs, the Yukon Lumberjacks. I call those the Salt and Pepper Shaker Tag Team Champions. They always had a match set. You notice that?
Yeah.
Other territories would have, like, you know, the Briscoe Brothers or two guys that wrestled similarly. The WWF always had these Salt and Pepper Shakers, Samoans, Executioners, Moondogs, Japanese guys that look similar. You know, they were always two of the same.
Yeah.
I didn't appreciate that. I thought, you know, it got a little samey after a while. It was always two of the same thing as the tag team heel champions. But in any event, that was Lou's milieu, and he was really good at it.
He was, man. I mean, he's one of the three wise men of the WWE. I guess they used to call them the three wise managers. But I just have good memories of him just growing up. He's one of the first ones, you know, you really remember. And it's funny because when I really first got into the business, and watching the business, you know, he was turning face. And that was so different, you know. And then I remember watching footage of him before that. And man, what a different character. I mean, when he was a heel, when he was with Snuka, and just, I mean, what a difference. I mean, I guess Vince made the right call turning him face because he had a successful career after that, that way. But obviously it wasn't the same. When he went face, it was just a completely different character. But do you remember, the one clip I saw was on Buddy Rogers had a talk show, the Rogers Corner.
Rogers Corner.
And I remember, I believe the Albano turn took place on that. I think Albano was with Snuka, and Buddy Rogers called out Lou, and he said, like, you've been stealing money from him or something like that. Yep. And that was when Snuka fired him, and he went with Buddy Rogers after that. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of the Snuka-Buddy Rogers pairing. But yeah, that was a good memory too. But what a different character from when he was heel to what he became during the Rock and Wrestling Connection.
Yeah, Lou, boy, would he gig himself. He is legendary for, there was always a feud that would culminate with one of the baby faces taking him on at Madison Square Garden in Philadelphia and all the other big arenas. And whether it was Pat Patterson, Gorilla Monsoon, I don't know if he ever wrestled Bruno. He wrestled Arnold Skolin, I remember, at one point, for attacking him or something like that. That's true. Lou had attacked Arnold Skolin, winning the Manager of the Year award one year. And so they ran Arnold Skolin versus Lou. And it was always the same thing. Lou would cheat with a foreign object, and then the good guy would take over, and Lou would bleed like an abattoir. He would gig himself so bad. I mean, John Arizzi has a famous photo where his face is just an absolute mask of blood.
Yes, I've seen that.
And it's like, but he always left the fans frustrated, because I believe in most of those matches, he would simply run away. Always leave him wanting more, said Lou. And it was the good guy would beat the crap out of him for about 2 minutes, leave him a bloody mess, but then he'd run away. No pin. Just a count out win. Pat Patterson was another one.
Yeah.
Pat Patterson took on Lou. I mean, it was like, those blow offs were always the same, but the fans loved to see him get the crap beat out of him.
And Lou was, I also have memories of Lou. Remember when he was on many, many times on the old Joe Franklin show in New York? Do you remember that talk show?
I do, and I thought it was so bad. I never watched it. I'm sorry. I wasn't a fan.
Oh, really?
I could either take suffering or leave it alone. And Joe Franklin was so monotone, and it was on so late, and I didn't really cotton to it. I watched it at times, like the time he thought Spinal Tap was a real band once. That was a classic. But I have to say that most of it escaped me, Joe Franklin. And I was there. I was in New York at that time, and I couldn't.
Yeah, no, it's okay. He wasn't for everyone, that's for sure.
Sure. Neither was Lou. Neither was Lou. Oh, remember Lou on Letterman?
I do.
And he went into his shtick with his shirt open, sitting there just rambling and incoherent, bragging. And even Dave was like, you could see, Dave was like, I got to get this guy out of here. He wasn't going over. I mean, he just was so obnoxious that apparently I think he actually did his job quite well, because you know what? Yeah. Everybody hated him. That was the deal back then.
Right.
You know, so let's hear it for Lou Albano, the walking fart. Also from that area, I'm going to make short shrift of this, because they weren't as popular, but a couple guys that were big in Canada, and one was Eddie Kreischman, who managed the Chic. The Palestinian brain, they called him. He was another totally obnoxious cigar chomping guy who I never understood. They let him run rampant on the ring apron in Detroit. I never understood that. Do you ever see those footages of the Chic matches? They would let the manager stand on the ring apron. What gives?
The managers would be on the apron while the match was on?
While the match was going on, constantly. I never understood it. Well, you know, how can you pass a foreign object if you're down below, I guess. And then a fellow who was really a great promoter and was a wrestling star in his own right for a while, George Crybaby Cannon, who was the first heel manager I ever saw. So he's got a special place in my heart. He managed the Mongols to a couple of championships, and also a late stint of the Al Costello Fabulous Kangaroos. I thought he was a great talker. He went on to do commentary on a lot of different wrestling shows in Canada with Milt Ev Ruskin, you know, Superstars of Wrestling, I think his federation was called. Mm-hmm. And you know what? He deserves a tip of the cap because of all the work he did in promoting wrestling in Canada. And in he also helped out with Dick the Bruiser for a while. Good talker, you know. Again, he was real obnoxious and loud, but he also became a face late in his career, and he could just talk very plaintively about everything he knew about wrestling. So I don't know. Did you have any views of him at all? Did you ever see him?
I have to say, I'm not that familiar with him. I really haven't seen too much footage of his. Definitely heard of him, you know, but as far as my ability to watch any of his stuff, I don't. I don't know if any of that stuff would be on
you YouTube. You can see him on YouTube on the IWA when Eddie Ironhorn tried to started a national promotion in the mid-70s. He's on there with the Mongols.
He is. Okay.
And I think he also managed Eric the Red, a character I never understood. A Viking with a bone, I just don't get. I never understood it. He was okay. He was a good wrestler, but, you know, good heel. But I never understood a Viking with a bone. That was just beyond me. I don't get it. So they later turned him to Eric the Animal. I think somebody realized something wasn't working there.
Yeah, right.
You know, so.
Right.
All right, let's go to the 80s. Pops into my mind is a guy who actually took a federation under his wing and kind of became the major heel there without being a wrestler, was Jimmy Hart.
Yep.
He managed everybody in Memphis, including Andy Kaufman. I mean, it was just, what a career. I never thought he would go to the WWE. I thought he was grounded in Memphis. But then he did go to the WWF and had a career just as long and just as successful. Probably one of the longest tenures as a manager in wrestling history. A great talker. Made you hate him. Didn't need the megaphone that made the siren noises. He was obnoxious enough just as he was. So I got to give it to Jimmy Hart. He was he's a legendary manager.
He is one of the greatest. You know, cut his teeth in Memphis. I mean, I believe he had the first family. It was called in Memphis. I've seen a lot of footage of that. He did. He managed so many wrestlers.
I just wrote down a few. Dennis Condrey and Bobby Eaton. The Iron Sheik he had in Memphis.
He did, yeah.
Randy Savage for a while. And everybody in between. I mean, he managed so many people that passed through there.
He did. And I mean, even Andy Kaufman, it's like, I think that gets forgotten about, that he managed him, because, you know, everybody just knows the Lawler Kaufman angle and stuff. But I mean, Jimmy Hart was involved with that. And getting signed, you know, obviously my first remembrance of him was with WWF. And I guess along with Heenan, you got to say they were the two main heel managers of the WWF in that glory period. Yeah, yes, it was really them too. All the heels, they were either going to go with Heenan or Hart. I mean, you had a few others, but I mean, the main event heels, it was almost like it was split between the two.
Yep, absolutely right.
And Jimmy just played his role to a T, and the guy never ages if you see him now.
No, he still looks like Jimmy Hart. It's amazing, isn't it?
Still looks the same.
Yeah.
And a great guy too. I first met him years ago when my wife and I went to Memphis to Graceland. We got at the airport and walking around and waiting for my bags, and I see him standing there. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh man, like this trip is really starting off on a high note. And my wife is like, well, who's that? And I was like, that's Jimmy Hart, you know? And I went over, I introduced myself. He came over, took pictures with us. And, you know, he was fantastic. So yeah, I mean, great guy as well.
He seems to be like that all the time. I actually had an opportunity to get to know him a little bit. He wouldn't remember me, I guarantee you. But Colin Bowman was the editor of WCW magazine that I later worked for. And I think I was in Baltimore attending a couple of days worth of shows, and we had lunch with Jimmy Hart. And they, you know, at that point he was in there with Hogan and stuff like that. And we had a really great conversation. It you know, we were talking about stuff going forward instead of back, but he was thoroughly immersed in the wrestling business and did a lot more behind the scenes than I think people know about, you know, not just in front of the camera, but I think he was also vital behind the scenes as a mind, as a really keen wrestling mind. So the fact that such a great guy has had such a success being a heel, I kind of like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And who can forget about his career as a musician before wrestling with the Gentrys?
Oh, yeah, Keep On Dancing, yeah.
Keep On Dancing, which is so cool.
But, you know, what made him so great, that obnoxious, high-pitched laugh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so good. You know, he'd be at ringside. His opponents would, you know, his men would be fouling the opponents. He'd be laughing. Ha, ha, ha. You know, it was so, everybody hated him, and for good reason. That's how it works. That's good stuff.
Seriously, yeah.
Now, another fellow who wasn't around as long is known for managing one team, but he was a riveting interview, unlike any other manager. Almost like this intellectual guy, Paul Ellering,
yeah,
managing the brutes that were the Road Warriors. Is another guy that could talk people in the building, and he did.
You're right. He, it's funny because he's so well remembered, but like you said, he really only managed a couple of guys. Mm-hmm. But it didn't matter because he was so closely associated with them. They went hand in hand. And he was excellent in that role. He really was a great talker. Really was I always felt he was an underrated figure with them. Definitely.
He would talk about stuff he invented in his mind.
Yeah.
That sounded like, ooh, something's going on here. Is there some faction against them or something? But he was just making this stuff up as he was talking, and it sounded legit. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a way of conveying, you know, everybody's out to get my Road Warriors, but, you know, we're too tough for them. And, you know, time is a very precious commodity. We'll show everyone. He would just say these things out of nowhere, and you'd go, well, he's mad. He's angry. These guys are, of course, he also had the most ferocious tag team of their era, which didn't hurt matters any.
And I think he did a lot for the Road Warriors as well, legit, right behind the scenes. I don't think it was just on screen.
Yeah, I think they were kind of like Bobby Davis. I found out through John and Rizzi that, you know, I didn't know this, that Bobby Davison was really the manager of Buddy Rogers. It wasn't an act.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he managed his affairs for a while, I guess. Or vice, you know, they kind of worked together,
yeah,
as a team, as a tandem. And I believe that if you were to talk to Animal and Hawk, they would say the same thing about Ellering. I mean, he was the guy that was in the business before they were and kind of guided them down a path. And it worked like gangbusters. Boy, were they box office, all three of them. Oof. No matter what, AWA, NWA, Japan, doesn't matter. They were ferocious box office. They were on, it was a little bit, they were a little bit past their prime when I joined PWI in 88. But go back to 83 to all those 80s years. They were on cover after cover after cover after cover. Only second, probably only to Hulk Hogan, I would think, in terms of covers.
You're right. They're one of the, I would say, other than Hogan, the Road Warriors in the later years, maybe Sting when he got hot. But I mean, the Road Warriors had to be up there with some of the most covers on all those newsstand mags. I mean, they were on all the time. They were so hot. And you know, eventually they made the jump to the WWF. And didn't really go as planned, I guess. But you know, at least they did it, and at least they got their shot there, even though it was, I guess you could say, it was screwed up a bit.
The WWF kept trying to give them a softer edge.
Oh, with Rocco.
Well,
right?
not just with Rocco, the puppet, or you know, which I'm sure Paul Ellering was thrilled about, but no, I think it just, they, you know, with Sonny as their manager, all this other, I mean, it was like they couldn't let them be what they were. They never do. That's what the WWF does worse than any other federation. They will take a successful wrestler, take a Terry Taylor, take a Road Warriors, take Billy Jack Haynes, take any of them, Junkyard Dog, and just make them softer. You know, family friendly. Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
Right.
Rowdy Bruiser in the UWF, but by the time he got to Ohio, it was all just fun for the kids.
The Bushwhackers.
It's unbelievable. The bloodthirsty sheep herders became ice cream bar salesmen. I don't know what to say sometimes.
You know, it worked. I mean, it worked for some of these guys. I mean, you know, it worked for the Bushwhackers. I mean, they were really kid friendly. You know, they had the merch and things like that. So I guess in some ways it worked. Other ways it didn't. You know, they weren't gonna hit the jackpot with all of them. But definitely with the Road Warriors, I would say it definitely they didn't treat it as the dream matches that they could have had. With right. Things like with the Road Warriors, Demolition, and the Powers of Pain, and just all these teams, you know, they could have really, really did more with it, and they just didn't.
And right from the beginning, they were in the WWE, the Legion of Doom, not the Road Warriors.
That's right. Changed the name, right. Yeah.
Changed the name, which was their nickname.
Right.
Became their main name because, well, that's what WWF does. They just do it all the time.
And the rumor at the time was that, oh, well, you can't have Road Warriors because you have Ultimate Warrior. You know, and it's like all this stuff. It's like, you know, God forbid you had two acts with a warrior in their name, you know.
But I don't understand why they continually revert the female wrestlers. By the way, I give them all the credit for building up the women's division. It's the best thing they've done in 30 years. However, why do they all have one name? Why can't they have two names like everybody else? Why is everybody just one first name? I mean, over and over and over again. I've never understood that. Well, they don't think the fans could, you know, Charlotte Flair. They remember that. Why can't they remember everybody else's last name too? I don't understand.
And it's not just the women. I mean, they've been known to do that in later years with all their talent. I mean, even like past 3 years,
yeah.
Cesaro, Austin Theory, who they changed to Theory for a while and then went back to Austin. And it's just, it's a head scratcher.
I honestly think they don't feel the fans can remember two names. It's just that simple. I think that's what the way they look at it. Enough of them. Close to Ellering in terms of mature credibility was J.J. Dillon with the Four Horsemen. Great talker. He was a wrestler. People don't remember that. The Sheik gave him his first break back in the old Detroit area. And one thing led to another, and he started managing people all around, I guess, the middle of the country. And somebody had the bright idea of putting him in with the Four Horsemen, and he was the money man for the Horsemen. And again, you would listen to him talk on an interview, and it would sound like real stuff. Great talker. Great pairing. Classic.
He was. He was an underrated talker. He doesn't get his due for that. But I think he fit in perfectly with the Horsemen as well. Mm-hmm. Because he was sort of no-nonsense, all business, wearing the suit on all his interviews. And I think to be with a group like the Horsemen, I think you had to have that type of personality, that somebody that looked the part. And he really did. I think he went hand in hand with Flair, Arn and Ole. Yeah. He really did. But I think he is very underrated in that regard. He doesn't get the credit he deserves.
Yeah. It reminded me of the money man, the brains behind the brawn, yes. Like the jet flying, high flying, kiss dealing, wheeling dealing, son of a gun. Yeah. Needed somebody to count the coins. And in my mind's eye, watching him, it was Dylan that was counting the coins.
Right.
You know, he was probably the one negotiating the matches. He would talk about it, negotiating the matches, getting title shots, keeping other people away from his champions. You know, that was Dylan's job. That's what he always conveyed on his interviews. I tell you what, he's one of the guys that made 605 such a great time period, yeah, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't remember him managing, to be honest with you, somebody other than the Horsemen before them.
He traveled the territories for a while.
He did. Okay.
He had a cigar. he managed that Bueller, if you can believe it, for a while.
Oh, wow.
Some other heels, like I think Brower for a while, Bulldog Brower. He had a kind of a different, he had a while to find his voice and find his niche. But whoever stuck him together with Flair and the Horsemen, genius, just worked. You know, they look like a wrestling company. The Horsemen,
yes,
did.
Yes.
Not just for rule breakers. They were all too smart. And Dylan was smart.
Yes.
So they were the intellectual rule breakers of their time. I don't know how else to put it.
Right. No, that's correct. Yeah.
You know, they would win by nefarious means. They wouldn't necessarily beat you to a pulp. There's a difference. Like Jerry Lawler wouldn't beat you to a pulp as a heel, but he would grab the ropes while he's pinning you. There's different ways to make the fans mad. And that was one of them. Just be sneaky. And the Horsemen, right, were sneaky. And who came up with a lot of those, you know, sneaky ways? James Dillon. That's who.
JJ. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Tip of the cap, of course, to Paulie Dangerously, who late in that decade, late in the 80s, became one of the best. Still doing it today. Do you think, I think he's setting some kind of a record in terms of being a mouthpiece. You know, I think he started early 80s and is still doing it. Can you imagine? That's a long time.
It is. I think one of the impressive things about Paul Heyman is that he's really evolved over the years as far as his role. I mean, you know, we remember him in the 80s and with the Dangerous Alliance and with these groups and, you know, carrying around the phone and, you know, whatever. But I think now he doesn't even call himself a manager. What is he?
Advisor or something.
The advisor. The wise man, you know,
right. But, he's the wise man. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just think it's impressive because I think he's really changed his role. He's evolved with the times. He's obviously in a completely different position in a managerial role as he was back then. The position he's in now with Roman Reigns is more of like a, you know, he's sort of takes care of all his business and he's kind of scared of him and he's just walks on eggshells with him. But, it's really impressive, yeah, about what that guy has done with his career, all the different people he's managed. And I mean, God, talk about an impressive stable, the Dangerous Alliance back then.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Steve Austin, Rick Rude, Medusa. It just was...
Arn and Bobby Eaton.
And Bobby Eaton. I'm forgetting them. Yeah,
Larry Zbyszko for a while.
What a stable. I mean, for a while he really was. I think him and the Dangerous Alliance were the best part of WCW for a couple of years there.
They saved WCW's ass. Is what they did. They were having a cold period. That's when Flair walked away,
mm-hmm.
And they needed somebody to bring people back in the arena. I think right about that point, the Dangerous Alliance got bigger and stronger. And they used Sting and the other faces. I remember the great cage match they had. Tell you what, I think the Dangerous Alliance at that point saved WCW. I do. They needed somebody to sell tickets, and they did.
Absolutely. Yeah, everything about him was just so it was just so innovative. And I remember reading out an interview that he did that the reason why he started using the phone was because he saw Gordon Gekko in Wall Street, and he decided to bring that into his gimmick, which obviously worked out really well. And I think he's just one of the he's got to be in the conversation for one of the all time greats. Yeah. Not only what his did, but just his longevity, like you mentioned.
It's unbelievable. You know, he always did play the rich kid from Scarsdale.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he had a cell phone when it was an innovation.
Yeah,
you
know, right.
Not everybody had a cell phone when he had the big, he had one the size of a shoe because they were all the size of a shoe at that point, you know? So he was cutting edge in that, but he had enough of a mental, that's the wrong word. He had enough of a history of wrestling in his mind that he took the philosophies of the old wrestling psychology of the Heenans of people like that and moved it into a more modern time. And I think he doesn't get enough credit for that. Cause you know, I spoke with him a lot when I was at PWI, and he really was a student of old school wrestling. He really was. And he would pick up bits and pieces, influences he'd wear on his sleeve and move them into the 80s and 90s. Didn't get enough credit for that. He's a great mind, just a great mind. So for that, he deserves a lot of plaudits, I think.
And I think he tried a lot of his, or he sort of fine tuned a lot of his act too in the early days when he did a John Arezzi show. You know, he was a constant caller there. And I think he would even admit that now that that's how he kind of fine tuned a lot of the character that we saw on TV after that. And speaking of Heyman, I mean, I think I mentioned to you as well, but if you haven't heard that podcast that Paul Heyman did just about a couple of weeks ago with Rick Rubin, Rick Rubin has a podcast that he does, a weekly podcast, Telemetron or something like that. It's a weird name, mm-hmm. but Heyman did like a 3-hour interview with him. And this just dropped a few weeks ago, and it is absolutely phenomenal. Heyman just talks about everything from growing up, from his background, from his family, his home life. He talks about his parents and his family in the concentration camps, and just he really just opens up about everything, including his mind, about how he sees certain angles and how he approaches certain things in the business. And it's a little lengthy, but it's one of those things, if you have the time just to listen to, I highly recommend it. It's phenomenal.
That sounds worth it to me. I really, and people forget about Heyman too. He worked everywhere. Continental. He booked IWCCW for a while. He worked AWA. I mean, he was never out of work. He was always somewhere causing havoc. So tip of the cap to Paul. Okay. I'm going to bring up a name that you may not have thought of in this regard, because he wasn't really a manager. But he was one of the most disturbing personalities in Florida, late 1980s, Kevin Sullivan.
Ooh.
Who later went on to WCW as a dungeon master and also the Varsity Club. He managed in various sites. But I'm giving this for that coterie of wackos he put together in Florida with with the unbelievably twisted Mark Lewin and The Lock and Luna Vachon and on, that whole and Bob Roop with half his head painted and the other half bald. I mean, a really disturbing bunch I have never seen like that. I mean, they were really, and here you had like Coach John Heath and Buddy Colt trying to call their matches like you're watching a sport while they're just like ramming guys' heads into turnbuckles and throwing them out of the ring and stomping them. It was the weirdest thing I think to this day I've ever seen. It was really odd. And it had a lot of guts putting that on TV. You know, to this day, Kevin insists there was nothing satanic about what they did. He never used the word devil or Satan. In fact, there's a little heat between him and Apter because, you know, Apter used the word Satan in one of the articles they wrote about him before I joined the magazines. And Kevin went back and said, I have never said the devil. I've never said Satan. So they kind of danced around it. It was more of a cult than a satanic thing, I think.
That's interesting.
You know what I mean? They acted like cult members.
Yeah.
You know, the Tree of Woe and all the other stuff that he talked about was all fictional gobbledygook, but it sounded satanic. They look satanic with the face paint and the eye black, and even they made the beautiful fallen angel look twisted and demonic. You know, it was just, it was an unbelievable act. I'm shocked that the TV affiliates in Florida allowed it on the air. It was wild.
That's interesting, because I never knew the story that there about the Heat, that he didn't like the word or satanic used. But now that you mention it, it kind of makes sense. It was sort of more of a cultish type of gimmick. But I mean, it definitely felt, I think to most fans watching it, you definitely felt it was some type of nefarious satanic type of devil worshiping. But if they never said it, then that was, I guess the way they got around it. It's funny. I just saw a clip of him and the fallen angel on a woman, on the old, Adam Parsons wrestling show this past weekend. They showed an old clip of him and she's in the back sort of foaming at the mouth and she's growling and he's like, his eyes are in the back of the head and things like that. So it was really entertaining. And you believed it too, you know, it was kind of so wacky. It was so out there, but he was pretty frightening. I mean, he was pretty scary. Well,
they ran some angles in Florida that really pushed the envelope like crazy, like stabbing Blackjack Mulligan in the chest with a spike, and it kind of hinted that he had a heart attack, and Dusty got spiked too, and the thing with Billy Graham in the desert introducing Mark Lewin by having him walk out of the ocean into the frame. I mean, this was stuff that is unlike anything else in wrestling. Most of it was set in the studio. I have to give Sullivan credit. I think the first off-site use of interviews and angles was done by him. I can't think of anybody who did it before that. I could be totally wrong.
Wow.
But he really did a lot of innovative ways to try to get over. And boy, did they get over, because I'll tell you what, Championship Wrestling from Florida sold a lot of tickets at that point. And that's the hallmark of a good manager.
That's right. I mean, they are there for the, you know, purpose of promoting their charges, promoting the matches, making people want to buy tickets. And he obviously did that in Championship Wrestling, yeah.
But it was wild, violent stuff, too. I mean, talk about pushing the envelope. Like I said, I'm surprised a lot of it got on TV.
Yeah.
Oh, at one point, he broke a bottle and stabbed somebody with it on television. I mean, that's kind of extreme. Of course, nothing compared to what they do now, but I don't know why. Funny. I say that now, and now they have matches where that would be considered a polite greeting. You know, these hardcore matches that they have now and the light tube stuff and the what's left of independent wrestling, it's just makes me soul sick, but that's a whole other topic.
Yes.
But now at the end of the 90s, as we discussed that, I will leave it with this. James Cornette. To me, if Heenan is one, Cornette is 1A. If Cornette is one, Heenan is 1A. To me, nobody, with not a wide array of charges, mind you, more so in his Memphis days. But by the time he hit NWA WCW, he only needed the Midnight Express.
Yes.
And boy, did they draw. And why did they draw? Everybody hated the rich kid from Kentucky. What a talker. To this day, an absolute wrestling savant, a genius. And I hate to say this, but if you got to know him, you'll know he's a nice guy, according to everybody I know and the times that I've met him. Sorry, Mr. Neckbeard and Miss Novering. He is a nice guy. I'm sorry. He is. And I am in awe of very few people in the wrestling business. I'm in awe of Jim Cornette. Case closed.
Yeah, I think that's always been the big debate, right? On Jim, who between Jim Cornette and Bobby Heenan. I think you had your WWF aficionados and WWF fans that went for Heenan. You had your NWA, WCW people that went for Jim Cornette. But I always felt they were very neck and neck. In the managing, Cornette, you can make a case that he was a better talker than even Heenan in some regard. It was different, but Cornette was unbelievable. And just he got into the business when he was like 13 or 14. And he did photography. Yep. He did ring announcing, timekeeping. He did so many different things. before he got to his niche or to what he did, which is so impressive. You know, he had a real love for the business. And
still does.
He still does. Yeah. I mean, he's looked at in a different way. You know, he's sort of a character, and with his podcast is great. You know, he's still very, very entertaining. I wish he was still in the business on screen.
Oh, me too. How in the world are people like Kevin Sullivan and Jim Cornette not booking somewhere? I don't care that they don't have hair. It makes no sense to me, and it never will. Dutch Mantel too. Those are guys who live the business every day of their lives. They know more about wrestling and they're under their fingernails than all these TV writers ever could.
Yeah.
I just don't understand why they're not still front and center in the behind the scenes workings of the wrestling business. It makes no sense to me. And every time that I think about that and think about where the direction things are going, and I start to get queasy, because you know what? We need people with that point of reference in today's, even in the majors. The wrestling psychology that worked for 50 years is waning now. Nobody cares about the suspension of disbelief. Jim Cornette does. Jim Cornette has quit jobs because he thought they sucked. He's walked away from money because he thought the product sucked, first and foremost. Who does that?
Well, I think that's a great point, and that almost answers your question. You're saying, how is someone like him not currently in the business? Where is somebody like Jim Cornette going to even work at this point? I mean, he's obviously not going to WWE. Is he going to go to AEW? No, because he's obviously burned that bridge, and he doesn't like what they're doing. Even a promotion like the NWA, which you know Billy Corgan, which you think like, okay, you know, going back to basics. NWA is not that good. The new NWA is really falling. It's not good.
I can't believe what happened to that. But well, that's a subject for another thing.
Yeah, it's another thing. But I mean, he is just, where is he going to work? Because, you know, he has these high standards that I don't even know of any promotion that he would be able to even last a week.
I admire that so much. He went and did LWPA announcing color commentary for a women's fledgling woman rather than do crap in WCW. He's one of the greatest people in wrestling history. I'm sorry. He just is. You know why? Because he cares about it with every fiber in his body, even now. He watches it. He says he doesn't like it, but you know, he still watches it. He's still rooting for it in his heart. You know he is. You know, You can't devote your life. His whole house is a shrine to professional wrestling. No, he's my most admired person in wrestling in my lifetime. We barely know each other. I think we met twice, but I don't care about that stuff. I never did care about meeting the guys. I tell the story a lot, but when I was with PWI, I was more interested in learning the business than kibitzing with the wrestlers, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of the guys I had pizza with, you know, Tony Altimore or something. You know, I didn't care about that kind of thing. I was really wanted to learn what made wrestling wrestling. I always kind of dreamed about being a booker, to be honest with you. But in any event, that's neither here nor there. Jim Cornette lived the business, cares about the business, has more integrity in his little finger than most of today's promoters have in their whole bodies. And I miss him being part of the scene. Thank goodness for the podcast, because I'm entertained for 5 hours every week.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's all I have to say. Brian Lass is a genius for knowing how to get the best out of him. I don't know what else to say other than without Jim Cornette, I wouldn't be watching a lot of wrestling. I'd rather listen to his show than watch current wrestling. I hate to say it. It's true. There's no question about that in my mind. Why? Because, you know, it has nothing to do with being older. It has nothing to do with changing times. It has to do with putting out a quality product. I'll give you the floor here.
I hear what you're saying. Definitely. He's a guy that he knows what he likes. His passion is unlike no other. I think you also hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, he's really critical of the current product, but he's still watching it. And, he's really just trying to, he's just trying to critique it, and have it a little bit closer to the way it was when he was around. I'm not going to say that I agree with everything he says. I'm not going to lie and say, well, I can't stand today's wrestling. I mean, I like, you know, I like AEW, you know, I watch it. I think they have some good stuff. Is everything that they do good? No, there's a lot of stuff that's on there that I don't like. I think he goes overboard, but I think it's part of his character. You know, he's got to be entertaining too. And obviously it's an entertaining podcast, and he makes some valid points, but, you know, you can't deny that he believes what he says. I mean, he is passionate. He is more passionate than probably anyone that's in the business.
And let's not forget why we're here. We're here because of that golden era, Dennis Condrey and Bobby Eaton and Stan Lane. Might be the greatest tag team of all time. I don't, like I say, I don't like to call anybody the greatest or the worst or anything, but they certainly are in the top five and drew a ton of money versus the Rock and Roll Express and other and the Fantastics, and they were fun.
Yeah. And also, don't forget, he's mostly associated with the Midnight Express, but an all really good pairing was him and Big Bubba.
In the day. The bodyguard,
The bodyguard. I mean, I think we all remember that. I guess it was, must have been 1986, the scaffold match, Cornette jumped off the scaffold, and I think Big Bubba was supposed to catch him, and he sort of missed it.
I think fell is the operative word. That's how the story goes, and he really messed his leg up with pain he still feels to this day, to be honest with you.
I'm pretty sure from what I remember Cornette telling us in an interview that Bubba was wearing sunglasses, and because the arena was so dark, but Bubba's gimmick was that he had to wear the sunglasses, he just couldn't really see Cornette coming down. So he was like 2 feet away from him. And that's when Cornette, like you said, screwed up his leg, and just so many good angles between him and Bubba and what's her name? Baby Doll, at the time, who was a big rival of his, but, yeah, I mean, one of the best parts of the NWA at that time, absolutely, was Jim
and
Cornette.
Let us not forget the late period feud with Paul E's original Midnight Express. And his current version, the heat, the angle with being smashed with the phone, the incredible face interviews the 2 weeks afterwards. Instant face.
Yeah.
Everybody sided with Cornette. Everybody sided with Jim Cornette, who they hated for 10 years. And yet now they were siding with Jim Cornette. And you know what? Probably the best interviews of his career is when he was talking to Schiavone after he got turned on like that. And seek those. If you can find them on YouTube, incredible interviews by Cornette explaining why this hurt him so badly. Well, just great. Just great.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so we have our 1 and 1A, and it doesn't matter who's the best, but we love them. We love them all. I have some missed opportunities, listener. We're going to wrap this up pretty quick, but I think if Tammy Lynn Sitch had remained a manager her whole career, she would have had a better career. The Jim Cornette Smoky Mountain Tammy Sitch was a great character and a great manager. You know, the highfalutin,
yes,
East Coast rich girl, prissy, mean-spirited, I get what I want.
Right.
If she got to WWE and it was all sex, if they had stuck with her in this guise, not the body Donnas and all that other silly stuff, I think she would have had a much longer, much better career. That's just my 2 cents. Really good. She was really good in Smoking Mountain. A natural presence. She could talk. Sure, she was pretty, but you know what? You know, the whole Rothschild thing was just worked beautifully for her. So I give her props for that. And also, there's a guy in the East Coast here named Boston, a couple guys. Tony Rumble, the Boston bad boy with his thick Boston accent.
Yeah.
Left us far too young. Good manager, managed Tony Atlas and IWCCW. I think if someone had given him a shot and toned him down a little bit, he might have been on a national stage. Maybe they considered him too regional or something, but he had a good mind too. I remember talking to him many times backstage about, you know, what they were trying to do with Tony and all that stuff. He knew it. He got the business, and a nice man. And I'm sorry he's no longer with us, Tony Rumble. There's a guy in his 70s named Beautiful Bruce Swayze, who was a worker, a little undersized. So he started to manage people like Ernie Ladd and the Love Brothers and the early Samoans, believe it or not. A great talker. I don't know why he never broke loose. And also, Luscious Johnny Valiant was a very funny very funny, original style, almost like a stand-up comic, which he later became.
That's right, yeah.
And I was thoroughly entertained by him. I remember laughing out loud at WrestleMania 3 when he ended an interview with Keskese, which made no sense because he was with Canadians. He was a really funny guy, and I thought he wasn't pushed hard enough. He had a couple tag team champions, I think. I think he had
Valentine and Beefcake.
Valentine and Beefcake, yeah.
Yeah.
But again, it was hard to break through that whole Jimmy Hart, Bobby Heenan deal at that point.
That's true.
Now,
that's true.
We left a lot of names. I left a lot of names out because to me, they just weren't as effective as managers. And some of them I know we're going to hear about. So I'll mention them right here. Fred Blassie, who I thought was way more effective as a wrestler than he ever was as a manager, just my two cents. I liked him as a manager, but I actually think he was too old school in that guy's. The Ayatollah Blassie I thought was weak. I'm sorry. I was just stretching it. I'm not saying I wasn't a fan. I'm just saying I didn't think it was as effective as other managers were.
I loved, I was a big fan of Blassie as a manager, but I see what you're saying. I liked that he was he seemed like an older guy at the time. I liked the dynamic between him and like Volkoff or the Iron Sheik, guys like that. I just remember being disappointed as a kid when he was being phased out of the WWF, I guess because of health issues, or I guess he just didn't want to be on the road at that time. And then they eventually, I think they transitioned his wrestlers to Slick. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, Slick did his job and Slick was fine. You know, he was entertaining as well, but I definitely miss Blassie, but I guess you really can't compare his wrestling to being a manager. I mean, wrestling, he was just a freaking maniac.
I am just old enough to have seen him.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And when his last WWF run in late 72, early 73, let me tell you, nightmares. The scariest, most ferocious heel I have ever seen. I saw the Sheik later. I saw all the other monsters, Bruiser Brody, all the monsters, heels. Nobody compared to Blassie. You know why? He wasn't even big. He wasn't especially powerful. Right. And he had no knees left by the time I saw him. And he was gray all over. But I'll tell you something right now. He acted like he was out of his mind. Mm-hmm. Like the minute the bell rang, he would start slamming his opponents with forearms and biting them. And it was just, he was a ferocious heel. And believable. Just the biggest monster. I don't know what else to say other than I thought he was so effective in that role that when they toned him down, I was disappointed.
Yeah.
You see, because I had that point of reference going in.
Right.
So toning him down to me was a waste because imagine him being just as vicious as a manager, but that's just another. And then also on the list of people we didn't talk about was Grand Wizard / Abdullah Farouk, who some people really have fond memories of. Sheikh Adnan LKC in the NWA. Percy Pringle, Paul Bearer,
yes,
is another one that would get a lot of votes from people. You mentioned Slick. There was a manager who traveled around named Sir Dudley Clements in the 70s and 80s who made his mark. Don't forget Eddie Gilbert with his Memphis Hot Stuff Incorporated. Mm-hmm. He was a manager too. In addition, remember he had Sting as his protege for a while.
Yes.
So, you know, there's a lot of, and on the list goes. Folks, if we left your favorites out, write to us at outdatedwrestling@gmail.com and vent. We will definitely read your comments on the show because I know this is the type of thing that it's like I said, these things are like Rolling Stones top 50 guitarist lists. Somebody's going to get upset.
You left out Mr. Fuji too. And Mr. Fuji gets so criticized. I think he won like the worst manager of the year award in the Wrestling Observer, like 6 or 7 years straight.
Yeah,
but you want to know something? Fuji, I always got a kick out of Fuji. I thought he did such a good job on those Fuji Vice, Fuji Vice things with Don Morocco. You know, was he one of the elite managers? No, probably not. But I think he was under it. I thought he did his little sneaky nefarious type heel role really, really well.
I'll say this about Fuji. He was hard to understand. So he got away with the most violent interviews during the kids era.
Yeah.
Oh, Hogan's son, we got to dab. The mango flesh drips the blood down your face. And and he was the only one doing that at that point. And if you really listened hard to what he was saying, half of his interviews were like him garroting people and stuff like that. So it was, you know, seriously, I'm not making this up.
I know.
If you look back at those tapes and catch a couple of Fuji's interviews, they let him get away with anything because nobody could understand him.
Yeah.
Which I found uproarious, to be honest with you. I found it very funny.
That's funny.
And I'm not saying these guys were bad. I'm just saying my list, and this was essentially my list, was about the ones that I found to be most effective and sold the most tickets. You know, that were the most, not necessarily the most popular. They could be hated and still draw people into the arenas. That was the difference back then.
Yes.
You could hate somebody and want to see them get beat. Now people count the number of spots in a match. It's the whole vibe is different.
It's true. I mean, there was an art to this role. There was an art to being a manager back then that's obviously not around today. It wasn't easy. I think a lot of people have a notion that anybody could do it. You can go out there and just talk trash, you know, and promote your guy. It's not easy because you can see how many that weren't successful at it. Just being a great wrestler doesn't mean you were ever going to be a good manager. I mean, look at Superstar Billy Graham. I mean, they didn't know what to do with him at the end when he came back to the WWF. They put him with like Don Morocco for a year. I mean, does anybody remember that? Mm-hmm. Not that there's anything wrong with him. I mean, Graham was one of the all-time greats, but as a manager, no, you don't want to see him. Even Buddy Rogers going way back, you know, he became a manager for a while. Does anyone really remember that too fondly? Probably not.
But you know, a good manager, or a good bad guy manager, I should say. And I'm still going to use the term bad guy. I don't care. I'm old. A good bad guy manager could manage a lump of clay and make you hate him.
Yeah.
Because he managed a lot of guys that couldn't talk at all. He managed Baron Mikhail Cicluna, and he had a raspy voice. He would manage a King Curtis who would howl and stuff like that. He'd manage Moondogs and Yukon Lumberjacks you couldn't understand, and down the list it went. They needed him. A talented wrestler needs a good mouthpiece.
Yeah.
Bobby Eaton, Jim Cornette. Not that Bobby Eaton was one of the 5 or 10 greatest wrestlers who ever lived, but he was not a great talker. Everybody would admit that. So when you had Cornette to do the talking for him, it made up for everything. That's why Correct. The managers were so important. I wish there were more today. I wish there were more straight managers today. And no, folks, Don Callis ain't cutting it. We need the type of guy who will make you mad. And they're few and far between anymore. Mainly because everybody talks like an old school heel manager now. You know, it's like everybody's a heel manager. LA Knight, who the fans love, is a heel manager. That's what he talks like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always wondered why the managers really went away in the first place.
Like yeah, me
why
too.
They started getting phased out. And there was talk for a while that, you know, the talk going around was that Vince didn't feel they were necessary. Like, why pay an extra body? Why bring them on the road? You know, although there's also that there was also always that talk that that's why he didn't want tag teams. You know, it's like, why have, you know, why pay more guys than you have to? But as far as managers go, I mean, I don't know if that's true. I just know that at some point they decided to phase them out, and then it sort of caught on in the rest of the industry, to whereas now you don't really have guys or girls becoming managers and that being their role. You have just maybe wrestlers that they decide, we don't know what to do with this guy. Let's put him with this guy and make him a manager.
There was a point in WWE when they became more mainstream, even into and past the Attitude Era, where things they used to do routinely in the ring, they would no longer do. Like, you'd see people hitting people with chairs, but you wouldn't pass a screwdriver from the manager to the. They didn't allow that anymore. You notice they stopped strangling.
Right.
Strangling is a big no-no on television. Have you ever seen anybody get strangled in WWE? No.
No.
Choking used to be a regular part of a bad guy's repertoire. You don't see that anymore, do you? Because it's that true. Was part of the softening with sponsors. And I remember Bryan Danielson got in trouble. Remember what was the Nexus? Remember when they took over WWF for an episode of Raw?
Oh, and yeah. And he choked out the ring announcer.
He got in trouble for that.
I think so he got fired for that, right?
It's either fired or put on suspension, one or the other.
Yeah.
But I know that there were certain things that became passe. Midget wrestling, you know, wrestling evolved in that regard. And I think it had to do with, you know, they wanted to do away with certain stereotypes. They wanted to do away with certain overly violent acts that kids could copy.
Yeah.
And strangling is obviously, if you had still people choking each other in every match now, I'm sure they do it in AEW, but I don't watch AEW much. I watched the Saturday Night Show. I liked it. I watched the show two nights ago and I practically threw my shoe at the TV. So that's AEW to me. I just, I don't know what to say. I'm not cottoning to it, as they say.
Yeah.
But you know who I cotton to? You, Joe Puccio. It's been a long time trying to get you here. I'm really proud and glad that you decided to spend a little time with us here. And I hope you come back and join us again. Tell people where they could find you and what you're up to at this very moment.
Oh, thanks, Bob. So you can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at JT Puccio, JTPUCCIO, both platforms. I don't post as much as I did at one time, especially not on Twitter anymore, but that's another story, I guess, for another time. and as of right now, I'm still doing the Royal Flush stuff. I'm still with eWrestling News. I do contribute from time to time on different sites here and there. But I'm just always looking for the next opportunity. That's about it.
So it's eWrestling News. And give them the handle for the website for Royal Flush. How do they find that?
That's RoyalFlushMagazine.com.
There you go. I want to make sure that they know where to go to find you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
No problem at all. This is one of the more prolific wrestling writers going right now, considering his resume. I'm really impressed with him and his resume. His name's Joe Puccio, and this has been a long time coming. Thank you for being here and spending some time with us.
Thank you so much, Bud. It's been a pleasure. Longtime fan, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
No problem. We'll have you back. So there was Joe Puccio in our rather lengthy show about wrestling managers. But you know what? There were so many great ones. Realize the number of people we never mentioned on the show. Probably some of them are your favorites too. If you do have favorites, let us know who you think they were. Just write to us. Just write to us at outdatedwrestling@buzzsprout.com. Our website, outdatedwrestlinghour.buzzsprout.com. You can listen to every single podcast there right on that website. You don't even need to open an app. We're right there waiting for you to enjoy. Twitter, Bob Smith NYC. Come see me. Facebook, plain old Bob Smith. Well, just Bob Smith, you know. You can see me singing with B.B. King on the main page, baby. You know what I'm saying? Proud moment for me. Also, I want to thank once again Brian Teo for his grooving guitar song called Hold On a Sec. Hope you enjoy it. We enjoy playing it for you every week here. And I'm going to sign off. My name is Bob Smith, the old wrestling writer, inviting you to next week's edition of the Outdated Wrestling Hour. We hope you had a good time. Come back and join us again, won't you? Please? And we'll see you in Philadelphia on July 1st for that fantastic convention. Until then, take care of yourselves and be good to each other, will you?